This is a University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center podcast. Judge David Volokh is an attorney in Sitka, Alaska, and in 2008 was appointed Chief Judge of the Sitka Tribal Court. He also serves as Magistrate Judge for the Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes and is Presiding Judge Pro Tem for the Aleut Community of St. Paul Island Tribal Government. He is introduced here by Dr. Ryan Fortson of the UAA Justice Center. In this podcast, Judge Volokh presents a context for tribal courts and Native law, outlines the development of Indian law in the United States, and discusses tribal sovereignty and the role of tribal courts in Alaska. This presentation was recorded on Monday, November 18, 2013, at the University of Alaska Anchorage, Alaska Pacific University Consortium Library on the UAA campus.
Hello, and welcome. I am Professor Ryan Fortson, Assistant Professor with the Justice Center here at UAA, and it's my pleasure tonight to introduce Tribal Court Judge David Volokh. As with most of these talks, I have a few thank yous before we get started. First of all, I'd like to thank the UAA Pre-Law Society for helping to co-sponsor this event and to help with setup. I'd like to thank the Justice Center for providing the refreshments. Barbara Armstrong, our intrepid editor of the Alaska Justice Forum, for her assistance in reserving the room and setting up this event. And also I'd like to acknowledge that tonight we have three judges from the Kenaitse Tribal Court, so thank you for coming to this event. Tribal courts in Alaska are an underappreciated, underutilized, and often not well understood aspect of the Alaska justice system. I'm not sure how many of you saw the headline in the Anchorage Daily News last Thursday regarding the federal panel, part of the Indian Law and Order Commission, that issued a report, one chapter of which was devoted to Alaska, and it was a very critical report of Alaska and the treatment by tribal courts, treatment of tribal courts by the state of Alaska. In fact, the report concluded that Alaska's approach creates and reinforces discriminatory attitudes about Alaska Natives and the governing capacities of Alaska Native tribes. And one of the suggestions of the report, in fact, the key suggestion of the report, was to try to shift a lot of cases, or at least increase the number of cases that are heard by tribal courts in Alaska, including potentially criminal cases. So it's very appropriate that we have our talk here tonight titled The Resurgence of Tribal Courts, A Tribal Court Judge's Perspective. And again, we are honored here to have tonight Judge David Volokh. Judge Volokh earned his law degree from Northwestern School of Law in Lewis and Clark. Upon graduation, he came up to Alaska, to Sitka, initially to work with the Indian Land and Trust Resources Department with the Sitka Tribe of Alaska. In 1998, he moved to Anchorage to join the firm of Landy, Bennett, and Blumstein, where he worked with David Case, specializing in Indian law, traveling to a variety of rural villages, and assisting in municipal and tribal matters. He also became one of the co-authors of the treatise Alaska Native and American Laws, which just last year entered its third edition. In 2008, after leaving the practice of law for a couple of years to engage in rabbinical studies, Judge Volokh returned to Sitka. In 2008, he was appointed Chief Judge of the Sitka Tribal Council. He was also hired as an adjunct professor of Indian law for the Lewis and Clark Law School's summer Indian law program. In 2010, he was appointed as a magistrate and judge for the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes. And then in 2012, he was appointed as presiding judge pro tem for the Aleut community of St. Paul Island Tribal Government. So with those many accomplishments, again, I'm pleased to introduce Judge David Volokh.
That's just silly to be at your own funeral, you know? Listen to the... Anyway, first, thank you for having me, and sorry for making you crazy by being late. Just got lost in the parking lot. You guys know how that is. First thing I want to say is if my voice sounds especially sexy tonight, you have my son to thank for that. He came home farschnatzik, which is a Yiddish word, and I don't think I need to translate it for you. And I said, dude, don't do it. And my son, of course, has to give you wet kisses. So I'm just recovering now. The other thing I'd like to do, beyond thanking the university and all of you for being here and spending your precious time with me, is to thank the people that lived here before we built all of these girder stone and lovely fluorescent lights. The people that raised me up, taught me to be mannerful. I am a stranger in a strange land, as you can tell by my garb. And so whenever I visit, I want to thank the people from this place for allowing us to be here. The other thing I want to do, of course, is to give a shout out to the Knightsey judges that are here. They're good friends, and it's actually very empowering to have them here. And they'll let me know at break if I'm off kilter. The last thing I want to do is apologize to you. And that is, before I start speaking, I can sometimes get worked up, a little bit frothy at the mouth about this topic. And if I do, I get excited, and sometimes I can say things that are offensive. And if I do, I got your attention now, don't I? If I do, I want you to accept my apology in advance. It's surely not my intention. Okay? All right, so we have some time together. Not sure how to spend it most wisely, so what I'm going to do is tell you a little bit how I ended up here. I have a bunch of law stuff that I don't mind sharing, but if you find it really boring, we can just jump into question and answer and topics that people find interesting, okay? And I did want to save time for your questions and answers. So the first thing I do is a parlor trick. I'm not sure if I've done this with the Knightsey yet, so if this is a repeat, I apologize. I learned how to read minds in rabbinical school. So what I'm going to do now is I want everyone to quiet their mind and have a thought, and I'm going to try to figure out what it is, okay? Can we do that for a second? Okay. What is a Hasidic Jew doing up here talking to us about tribal courts? Are you ready for me? Okay, great. My AV people are awesome. So what happened was, a funny thing happened on the way to the store, right? So I ended up, through all kinds of bizarre things that I cannot tell you now, I'll meet you at the pub later, ended up on the Baranof Island, working with the Tlingit people in Sitka. And being the young hippie wannabe, I was throwing myself into the culture there, which was amazingly rich, if you know anything about any of the native people all over the world. And Tlingit people, much like Jewish people, their mothers like to have either doctors or lawyers as sons. And so me being a lawyer, I became attractive to a number of suitors, and they were circling me like sharks, about adopting me culturally into their tribe. And one very special woman, who is extremely spiritual, felt that I was a reincarnation of her son David, and she had lost him to a drowning accident. And she asked me if I would become her ceremonial son, and I was honored and, of course, said yes. And a few weeks before the adoption ceremony, she was visited in a dream. And her grandmother came to her and said, "No, who's this?" She said, "This is David. He's an attorney with our tribe, and I want to adopt him." And the grandmother says, "That's good. Did you pick out a name for him?" And she said, "Yes." And she gave this 10-gallon name that I cannot pronounce. And it was the name of a deceased chieftain of their line Because much like Jewish people, the Tlingit people want to carry names on in living people. And the grandmother grew stern with her and said, "You cannot give him that name. He comes from his own tribe." Jesse wakes up. She comes to me. She says, "What tribe are you from? My grandmother says you're from a tribe." I was bar mitzvahed on the suburbs of Philadelphia, you know. And so began a whole process. Oh, hey, you. Oh, I didn't see you back there. I think I recognized somebody there. I could be wrong. I sometimes do. Anyway, so began a process of reawakening of who I was. And I have the Tlingit people and the native people of Alaska for accepting me for... Okay, hopefully there's nothing embarrassing here. Anyway, I'm going to finish my spiel and then we'll deal with the computer. Because you know what a trap that is. And so began a process of both of us. And the thing that hit me between the eyes was there was an elder named Mark Jacobs. Mark's awesome. He's walked on, as they say. Classic dude. I would love to tell you a story. Well, I will, because whatever, you know, it's our time together, right? So Mark was one of these classic elders that had two hearing aids. And when he didn't want to hear what you were saying, they weren't working so good. But nothing passed Mark, right? So he came over to our house for a dinner party an hour and a half early. So as you can tell by me strolling in 10 minutes late, I'm not one of those dinner party preparers that has all the napkins folded an hour before the party. My kitchen is flying. I am freaking out. I did not take a shower yet. And in knocks Mark. And his family drops him off and drives off. And I've got this 90-year-old man, double hearing aids, sitting on my couch. And I don't know what to do. So at that time, we had two cats. And there's cats are either one of two main phylums. They're either super sweet and nice, or you can never talk to them, right? And so the two cats I had were the kind that jump on you and start rubbing their tails on your face and gnawing on you and covering you in fur, right? And I'm watching them crawl on the head of this Tlingit elder and shove their tails in his face and do the whole nine yards. And I'm like, oh, God. So I scream from the kitchen, making small talk. "So, Mark, do you like cats?" Right? Nothing. So I'm like, okay. So I'm back to short order cooking. 10 minutes later, I guess, out from the living room comes... I'm going to try to do this, and he has a very raspy voice, okay? So I'm going to channel Mark for you right now. "On the sixth day, the Creator finished all the works of creation and gave man dominion over all the animals, except for cats." That was Mark Jacobs. But the thing that he said that's more than just humorous is that every day he would stare me in the eyes and he would say, "David, our people, our culture, our language, our children, so important. You must help us." Day in and day out. After a while, when the elder walks into your office and you're doing 1,000 things, you know, you're not giving them the attention maybe they deserve, Mark would do it again. And there's a famous metaphor of a drop of water can eventually carve a canyon. And finally, Mark's drops started to, excuse me, penetrate this thick cranium. So I took a sabbatical from law, got back in touch with where I come from, and then decided to come back. And if I have time, I'll tell you the story why. I'm not sure. I'm worried about burning all of your time and stealing your questions and things of that nature. But I think I can speed up a little bit. Let me just find this PowerPoint. I made my first PowerPoint. I'm so proud. And it's completely irrelevant to my talk, but I don't care. I want you to see it. Let's see. Oh, it's got that great little PowerPoint icon, right? Okay, so this is where I need someone to help me. I think I go to view. Oh, well, okay, we'll accept the recommended settings, I guess.
No, don't.
Damn. You guys scared me there. Okay. So somehow there's like a slideshow way to look at it, I think.
We'll just go with ask me later.
Okay. Oh, perfect.
It's a little bit difficult when you're trying to look at the
right,
screen there. That's
exactly.
A little better.
Oh my God. Hello, Ryan.
All done.
Okay, so then how do you make it? Yeah, you must know.
Where is the slideshow?
Oh, one more right there.
Slide. Okay. From the beginning. How about that?
Okay. And how do I... Oh, I can just move it here. Perfect.
Yeah.
All right. Well, super. So, hello. Okay, and it gives you a preview, I guess. All right. Yikes is all I got to say to that. You know, I'll probably make this available to you in writing. You can follow up on some of the research. Okay, so this is the story I want to tell you real quick. How are we doing on time, Ryan?
We're great.
All right, super. You with me? Okay, so this is one of the weird things that happened to me while I was working in this field, and I want to share it with you because I think one of the questions I try to ask myself and encourage other people to is, why is this important? All of us know we've lost loved ones. We see how quickly children grow. We get up in the morning and go, ooh, yikes, that's gray, right? So we know none of us are here forever. We have a certain amount of time allotted to us. And why are you going to spend your time farting around? Pardon me, that's a term of art. You know, we can have a good time. Believe me, I'm a former sports on television addict. I'm doing much better now. I'm in recovery, but we try to do important things with our lives and with our time. So I want to tell you a story, and this story exists across the globe amongst, I'm betting, almost all the peoples, and it's a story of a flood. Is that weird? It's one of those things where people just go, isn't that weird? And then they're like, can I have another? You know, it's like, no, that is strange. There is a story of a grand flood all over the earth. So the version I can tell you is the only one that I really know. And it's in Hebrew, and I'm telling you that because there's some weird words in it that are not normal, and they're there to catch your attention, okay? So you know the story. There's going to be a big rainstorm, and this voice comes out of the sky and tells a righteous man named Noach, or Noah, build for yourself, and in Hebrew, it's a teva. And there's no good translation for a teva, so they feed you in the King James Version, an ark. You all know the picture, right? And my judges here have heard this before. The plush toy at Toys R Us with the giraffe's head sticking out, right? Isn't it cute? But this is a serious story. What is a teva is my first question for you. And next, Noach is told to build a tzohar, shall you make. What the heck is a tzohar? Anybody? Come on, Bueller. No? Nobody knows. So you're in the majority of not knowing what a tzohar is. And then the last commandment is you and your family shall go into this teva. Now, the Old Testament is highly detailed on the architecture of this thing. And if you look at it, it's actually a large box. It is not a boat at all. And a tzohar, nobody's sure what it is. Some people say it was a window. Other rabbis say it was a skylight. And then there's another opinion that says it was a large, opalescent, light-giving stone. A little weird now, isn't it, people? A large box with a magical stone that gives off its own light? Not normal. Because, if you follow the text, the sun and the moon cease shining during the flood. So what do you need a window for? What are you looking at? How about a skylight? Darkness. So that opinion says this Tzohar gave off its own light. Cultural trauma is a lot like a flood. Mayim Rabim is it in Hebrew, a great torrent of waters. And if you don't build a teva, you could drown, God forbid. My friends, my cousins, the Alaska Native people, indigenous people all over the world, are experiencing a flood right now. It's not relegated to the history books like the Washington Redskins would like you to believe. It's happening right now. And Noach and Naamah were charged with taking all of the seeds of life, animal and plant, and putting them in this bizarre, huge, magic, opalescent box. For when the floodwaters recede, they open the door and were ready to replant and regenerate life. So too, indigenous people are in the process of building a teva to withstand the Mayim Rabim, the torrents of waters that are going on in their villages, their neighborhoods, their countries. Why is this important? Well, we like to believe all humans have an inherent right to self-determination. Sounds good. We signed a Declaration of Human Rights to that effect. You get to decide who you are. I don't tell you what to look like, what to wear, what to talk, or how to worship, or what to eat, and the list goes on. Well, if that's not good for you, if that's feeling too oovy groovy, let's move down the list. Health, safety, and welfare of the native people. My cousin and great Indian law scholar Felix Cohen wrote a handbook. And the front of the handbook says, like the miner's canary, native people mark the shift between fresh air and poisonous gas in our society. Does anybody know what a miner's canary is?
Yes.
Tell me. Right. When it stopped singing in its little cage, you knew things weren't well. The report that Professor Fortson talked about, I highly commend you to. It's the Indian Law and Order Commission. And guess which state got its own chapter? The only one of 50 states. Our beloved Alaska, the Great North. And every statistic is mind-bogglingly horrid, from physical violence to sexual violence to children in the protection system, the juvenile system, incarcerated natives, every kind of social category we'd rather not mention. Natives are beyond overrepresented. In Juneau, where I work, Native children make up 80% of the welfare docket. They're only 11% of the population. If I'm getting worked up, it's because the miner's canary is not singing. And it's not me making this stuff up. It's not even close. Like when I hear solutions to the problem, well, we'll put more police out there. Or let's sign an agreement and we'll start working together. Great. If you can improve things 25%, one quarter, that is immense results. And now they're only 60% of the population. It's not even close to fixing right now. The miner's canary is not singing. And you know what? If you want to be University of Chicago, Mr. Economist, and it doesn't bring tears to your eyes, it's costing billions of dollars. So if you want to play to the right or to the left, I don't care. Either way, it's a nightmare. Ah, but if that's not working for you, the last thing I want to talk to you about is the library of collective experience. Each one of us, with these brains we were given, is a book. And our families, our traditions, our ancestors have handed down some information to us on how to survive, what to do, how to be married, how to raise children, how to have education, how to live healthy lives. If you're going to burn, we're in a library right now, right? Think of Nuremberg. If we're going to burn whole wings of our library because everybody's got to eat a Big Mac, we are setting ourselves up for some issues, is all I'm going to say. Because as we know, every successful species, I'm doing biology on you now, has multiple approaches to stressors. And if we don't have the native people and indigenous people sharing with us, like, oh, hey, yeah, this is how you might tackle that problem, we've burnt a part of our library. And the funny part is, as my colleagues know, guess who's coming calling? The Anglo-American adversarial system of justice is floundering. Our dockets are full. Nobody feels justice is being served. And the only one getting rich is us lawyers. No, I'm just kidding. It's no good to talk without a lawyer joke, right? Seriously, there's some very good lawyers that I know. Anyway, but the justice system is not serving us, right? And so courts from New York all the way over are now going, wow, we need to figure out another way to solve problems and to, you know, broach disagreements. Let's look at the Native American model, right? And so all the mediation and therapeutic courts are now trying to study the Native American traditional justice system. But what happens if you're burning the library? Anyway, questions to think about, okay? How's time, Professor? Still doing okay?
Doing great.
All right. We are going to fast forward a little bit. Huh, but I want to give you a little bit of background before we talk tribal courts, okay? So why did I get into Indian law? Well, you can tell because a lot of it has to do with God. It's so fascinating when you go back to the roots of federal Indian law. And you go back to the 1400s and it's all about divine rights and things of that nature. What I did want to point out to you is there was a very lovely debate going on in Spain back in those days when they were trying to figure out what they were going to do with the lands they were colonizing and the people that they met there, which was highly inconvenient. Oh, what are you doing here? So there was a debate between a philosopher named Sepulveda, and then against him was Las Casas, and then the middle guy was De Vitoria, who they eventually went with. And Sepulveda argued that native people were accursed and were less than human and their destiny was to be slaves. Las Casas was the first hippie before there were any hippies. An amazing story. I don't have time to tell you the whole story about him. Suffice to say, he was a very wealthy, upper middle class, well-educated young man who had vast land holdings in Hispaniola and was making a mint. And one day he had what Samuel Jackson entitled in Pulp Fiction, if you've ever seen it, what alcoholics call a moment of clarity. Do you remember that? What a movie. Anyway, he saw a brutal massacre and said, what in God's name are we doing? And he became an ardent debater and advocate of Native rights back when, in the 1490s. And he was an amazing orator and got all the way up to the Pope. And his way actually won, but it was impossible to administer thousands of miles away. Because the conquistador don't give a crap about your decree about the natives and their rights. Okay? So eventually they went with De Vitoria. Yes, natives are human, but there are all kinds of footnotes about how and why we can dispossess them of their land and fight what are called just wars against them. Okay? So that was the middle road position, which allowed all the way up to our beautiful nation where we sit now. And just for history's sake, we'll buzz through this, but you should know that everything west of the Appalachian Trail in the early days was known as Indian country. The king's laws did not apply there. The native people's laws applied there. And if you decided to cross the line, good luck. And this concept is still in play on this debate over jurisdiction. And you'll hear that term, and that term's from the 1600s. Okay, so that's the interesting piece about what you read in the Anchorage Daily today. It's an old story that's winding its way through time. Okay, with our fine Declaration of Independence and our overthrowing of the British government, the United States of America became the new king or sovereign. And if you look in the word sovereign, you'll see the Latin word for king. So whenever we discuss sovereignty, we're going all the way back to the divine right monarchs being able to talk to each other. Okay? Our Constitution is incredibly terse when it comes to Native Americans. There's one clause which says Congress has this power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and Indian tribes. And so you start to see that Indian tribes, as we will find out in a moment, are inherently sovereign. Okay? No one gave them this power. If I could swallow all the vomit I've had at cocktail parties where people start telling me what we gave the natives. Hopefully everyone in this room understands that, nope, they were sovereign before anyone put a pinky on this land. But as you will find, if you start studying this for real, that's highly inconvenient. And so if you read our legislative history through time, you'll see that many congressmen, senators, presidents will discuss what's called, and they don't mince words, the Indian problem. So eventually, the chief judge had to decide, this is on Walter Echohawk's 10 Worst Indian Law Decisions Ever, a book I commend to people. I need to read it myself, actually, but it looks fascinating. He takes the 10 worst Indian law decisions ever decided and guest writes chapters about it. So they decided that Congress has plenary power over Indian nations. This means when all else fails, watch out for Mr. Big. But it needs to be tempered by a trust doctrine. This is a fiduciary responsibility. That means if you are a trustee for a child, you need to take care of their money. You cannot run off to Vegas with it. Okay, for all those parents who've been collecting permanent fund dividends for your kids. You need to take care of it. You need to use it in their best interest. So too, Congress's great power needs to be used as if it was a trustee. And we have these special things that have fallen into disfavor lately in our United States Supreme Court called the canons of federal Indian law. For the most part, the canons mean if there's confusion, if there's an ambiguity in a law, if you're not sure quite what to do, you are to decide it in favor of native rights, not against native rights. And our beloved United States Supreme Court has decided that's inconvenient. Here we have an Indian problem again. And so they're going the other way. In the last 30, I think, Indian law decisions that have been in front of the United States Supreme Court, tribes have lost 27. Yikes. All right. All right. So some of that's land stuff. We're not going to get into all that. Let's get to tribal courts, right? That's why we're all here. Are we moving? There we go. Oh, there's so much fun history to discuss about Alaska. Suffice to say, none of the early stuff dealt with the natives. So again, if you hear at a cocktail party someone tell you that Russia sold Alaska to America, try to choke it back, okay? Because that's not true. Russia never had control over Alaska. It was what we like to call in the law a quitclaim deed. I'm selling you whatever I have, even if it's nothing. All right, well, it is important that we realize that eventually there was a very big native problem in Alaska. Does anybody know what that might be? That's right. Aboriginal rights over land. And what in particular sure got people burning? Oil. That's right. And they needed to build a pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to an ice-free port in Valdez, and Aboriginal claims sat all over the right-of-way. And so Congress got a-moving, and they passed an absolutely revolutionary law, there's none like it in our country, called the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, sometimes called ANCSA. You'll hear people bandy that around. And it was designed to extinguish this Aboriginal title. There was a cash settlement and 45 million acres, but here's the kicker. It was given in fee simple to for-profit native corporations. No other settlement ever is with corporations. It's always with the sovereign. Remember what we were talking about? King to king, queen to queen, sovereign to sovereign. Somehow, they tried a new thing, and if you look at the legislative history, they will tell you, quite unabashedly, it was a social experiment designed to assimilate Alaska natives. That's exactly what they wanted to do. It's not me being a liberal freak over here. Look in the record. They'll tell you that's what they wanted to do. Just like in the old days, it was the Bible and farming. Now it was capitalism. And the magic words was they wanted to avoid any permanent racially defined institutions or a prolonged trusteeship. These magic words would create confusion for the next 30. Yeah, we're going on 40 some years, and it's still happening today. What do I mean? Let's go. Boom. Okay. Are there tribes in Alaska? Many people will tell you, no, thank you to ANCSA, there are no tribes anymore, if there ever was, in Alaska. And our lovely Department of the Interior contributed to that confusion by putting corporations on the list of native entities. So there was no difference between a native corporation and an Indian tribe. Finally, in 93, Ada Deer published a list that said, oops, we've been mistaken. Every tribe on this list is indeed a federally recognized, inherently sovereign Indian tribe with all the rights and privileges of tribes down in the lower 48. Well, you can imagine some people popped a sprocket, and there was a whole bunch of litigation lawsuits about that. Luckily, Congress ratified Ada Deer's list the next year. And finally, the Ninth Circuit, and believe it or not, there was a case this year that is still dealing with this. So all three branches of the federal government have said, guess what? There are 229 or 230 tribes in Alaska. Okay, so now we're getting back to that question of Indian country. So the definition is Indian reservations, Indian allotments, or dependent Indian communities. The native village of Venati reselected their reservation, but it was now in fee simple because it was Angsa land, okay? They did a little switcheroo, then they quick claimed it right back to their tribe, and then they charged a tax on the state of Alaska. Quick moment about a bizarre love triangle. The federal government is the primary sovereign dealing with Indian tribes. States have very little voice whatsoever. States do not like competing sovereigns. It's known. And so states, you'll notice one special magic word in every lawsuit dealing with sovereignty, and that is the state of Alaska. And they fought, you can imagine what happened when Venati taxed Alaska, and they went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and I told you how our stats were doing up there, didn't I? And so the question was dependent Indian communities, and the Supreme said, Angsa land lacks the requisite level of federal superintendence to qualify as a dependent Indian community. Therefore, Angsa land is not Indian country. And the famous term is, there are tribes in Alaska, but they're sovereigns without territorial reach. Well, that makes life very confusing. And then it got even weirder the next year. So just so you know, this is what the petri dish of native law looked like for the longest time in this state. Public Law 280 divested tribes of jurisdiction. There are not now and never have been tribes of Indians in Alaska, as that term is used in federal Indian law. This is our Supreme Court, Alaska Supreme Court. ANCSA abolishes all claims to tribal status and sovereignty. That was the prevailing belief, the legal precedent. Non-reservation native villages, that means everyone but Metlakatla, lack any authority of sovereign government. That was the state of the law in Alaska. We're getting there, I promise you. And then came a sea change. Our Supreme Court pulled up the emergency brake and went into a spin, and then hit it into reverse. In an amazing decision, the Supreme Court said, yes, there are inherently sovereign Indian tribes in Alaska. I know we've been playing I'm pretending you're not there for the last 30 years, but it's time to take the glasses off. And guess what? They can adjudicate core tribal matters. Sovereignty is tied to their political citizenship, not land, and state courts are to provide respect through a legal term called comity for tribal court judgments. What I want you to understand, and it can get funky, I will admit, Indian law is based on sovereignty, not race. And a lot of people fundamentally misunderstand what this whole body of law and tribal courts and Indian tribal governments are all about. They are the sovereigns from inherently always since time immemorial. It's a political relationship between the United States as the new king and the tribal government as the king to negotiate with. It's called government to government. You will see that in federal executive orders. It is not racial. Now, the weird part is tribes are great extended families. And so they use family trees often, or for many years the Bureau wanted them to have blood quantum. But really it is, are you a citizen or not? And the tribe decides that. You could have one drop of blood, technically, you really don't need a drop of blood. Or you could have a ton of blood. Doesn't matter. It's up to the tribe. And that's what's so disturbing. If you pick up baby girl Veronica, this was a case, a harrowing Indian Child Welfare Act case that just rattled through our United States Supreme Court, the Phil, Dr. Phil show, CNN, Oprah, the whole night. It was a nightmare. It was like watching a train crash in slow motion for this child. South Carolina, Oklahoma. But you read the first line of the Supreme Court's opinion. The first line. Hello, typewriter. I'm sitting down to write an opinion that's going to be read by tens of thousands of people. This is about a girl who's only 365ths Cherokee. From that sentence on, I couldn't see. Because if you understand Indian law, that is the most irrelevant thing in the world. And it shows those judges don't get it, or they're playing the race card. Sorry, that was my soapbox for a minute. So then, Alaska gets beat in the Ninth Circuit. And the Ninth Circuit said, listen, Alaska, you need to give full faith and credit to tribal court adoption decrees. Well, I told you we were getting to tribal courts, didn't I? Indian country is not required. And then the ball kept rolling. Okay, and all these, if you start noticing the dates here, we are very much alive. And it keeps going. Indian law is morphing at an incredible rate in this state. So if you're interested in this, so am I. Native village of Tanana. Tribes retain their inherent sovereign jurisdiction concurrent with the state. That means the state and tribes have co-equal, parallel civil sovereignty over their people. And they went further. They took a whole bunch of stinky sock decisions that they had on their books that these people who are fighting sovereignty keep citing to. Oh, but you said it in the matter of FP. And what about Nana and Nanana? And the Alaska Supreme Court said, we were wrong, overturned. And that's not normal, okay? As you know from stare decisis and precedent, courts do not overturn themselves lightly. And our Supreme Court has just completely moved in another direction. And I want to tell you, it's not because they drank the Kool-Aid. If you read these decisions, they are sound, brilliant Indian law decisions. I wish our United States Supreme Court would read these cases because they are solid based on the foundations of sovereignty and Indian law. And like I told you, just a couple years ago, somebody was arguing that there's still not federally recognized tribes in Alaska. And they were arguing, by the way, you made a mistake in John V. Baker, and you should overturn John V. Baker. And our Alaska Supreme Court said, thanks, but no thanks. And then this, my alma mater right now, we just won summary judgment in Juneau saying that we have the inherent sovereignty to handle child support and paternity. But of course, why wouldn't a tribe? John V. Baker already told you they could handle custody and visitation. But our lovely sister sovereign is arguing tooth and nail, every inch. All right. So this case just came out very powerful, as you can see at the date, 2013. Again, the Alaska Supreme Court overturning multiple precedents, saying that they've been getting the Indian Child Welfare Act all wrong. and making it much stronger. All right, and then we'll, hopefully we have a minute to start getting into tribal courts. Okay, sorry. So, come on, Mr. PowerPoint. There we go. We still have a problem that's going on, as my friends know. And I call it, except for in Alaska, still this pervasive, I don't know what it is, that somehow Alaska is different and that Indian law should not apply up here. And it's been successful to have Alaska exempted or pulled out of major, major national tribal court empowerment legislation. By our own legislators, exactly. First one, we need to fix the nightmare in Indian country. What I told you is going on in Alaska is going on throughout the country. Indian country is a vacuum of law enforcement because of all these jurisdictional issues. And guess who likes to go there? Drug dealers, pedophiles, and rapists. Lovely, right? It's like Disneyland for people who are sociopaths because of the law enforcement and tribal court jurisdiction problems. I think there's a famous TV show, right? I saw it once. It freaked me out. What's the one about the science teacher that starts cooking meth or selling meth? Breaking Bad, right? This is in national entertainment. Where do they go to cook the meth? The Indian reservation. I wish it was a joke. It's not. And so they passed this law to strengthen tribal courts, except for Alaska. Ah, but it gets better, doesn't it, my friends? Just recently, they reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act. And because of this vacuum of justice, Native women are raped and brutalized orders of magnitude higher than any other ethnic population of women. Yes, go ahead.
And we just talked about it. It needs to be clarified that Native women are raped and pillaged, not by Native men.
Right. So that's the other piece of it. I just finished a book called The Roundhouse. I don't know if you've ever read that. It's by a woman from Minnesota. It's a fascinating book. But in the appendix, 80% of the offenders are non-Native. Yeah. So what they did again was they needed to empower tribal courts. Because of jurisdictional holes, rapists and domestic batterers were flocking to Indian country, non-Natives, because the word was out. If you wanted to get, you know, your jollies, uh-oh, wake up. Are we running out of power here? Yeah, it looks like maybe we're running out of power. Okay, so where do you go? You go to Indian country. So they reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act to empower tribal courts to handle offenders, tribal or non-tribal, and except for Alaska. Anyway, let's talk about tribal courts, shall we? I'm open to questions and answers, I think is the best way to go. I've yapped at you for like an hour, and I appreciate everyone's attention, but I wanted to share whatever I might know, and I will defer to my colleagues early and often. Yes? That's a great question. That is a great question. You know, there's 230 tribes, and each tribal court, it will be very different. And so that's a toughie. You know, the best would be to get on a bush plane and go around and spend a couple months in each village. You probably don't have time for that. One thing that I saw that was pretty powerful, and then I'll defer to my colleagues if they've seen anything, is by a woman named Ada Pecos, P-E-C-O-S. And she wrote a little article on the fundamental differences between traditional indigenous justice systems in the big macro and Anglo-American justice systems. Kind of a side-by-side comparison. And she's a great writer, and I thought she did an amazing job of something that's not easy to capture. The one thing I can tell you about, I guess, you know, practically speaking, when I sit on the bench, I am not higher than my parties. We sit down with them in a round table situation, and I'm not there to be on a bully pulpit and start wagging my finger or banging my gavel. I really want, if anything, I view myself, if I can pull out whatever it is that's going on so that the people can decide for themselves, because they know much better than I do what's good for their families. I always say that. When a child's at issue, you guys know this child, you love them. Let me be a facilitator, I'll give you that. But I'm not here to start. And that's kind of what goes on, unfortunately, in Superior Court. Someone that does not know your family from Adam will give you, sometimes, I had one emergency expedited custody hearing. There were knives being thrown at these children, and the judge gave us a half an hour. Now, maybe it was because of the stack of files on his desk. Maybe. I don't know why. But I was like, I need respiration, that someone was going to give these children 30 minutes and then go, burr, burr. And so that's, I know how our tribal court is different. It's meant to be a welcoming environment. We have a'u, which is like ceremonial artwork everywhere. And the lighting is brought down. We've built a little playroom. We're very lucky. We have an antechamber that nobody really uses. And so we've made it so that kids like to go in there and like hang out, because we welcome kids in our court. So it's just freaking different. Knightsey, please help me out here.
One of the things that you have picked up is peacemaking courts. You might be able to Google that, because it's the pendulum is swung that way. Peacemaking kind of gives you the Indian flavor, but like Judge Volek says, is that every court is different. But that might help. For me to explain it, it's very similar to the way we adjudicate would be like civil mediation. Except you would be in two different, in some civil mediations that are done, and they're done inaccurately or incorrectly, would be that the parties are in two different rooms. We bring them together. And the other difference is, I love it. We don't care if you bring your lawyer in. You can bring as many as you want. But I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to hear from them. I want to hear from the parties. I want it from their mouths. And if the attorney thinks that maybe they forgot to tell me something, then maybe they need to speak. But no offense to some of us who've taken law, but from Justice, and I can quote Justice Thorne from the lower 48, our lawyers are much of the problem in our judicial system. Sorry.
It's more non-confrontational. It's basically something's happened. We're there to fix it, not to find a winner and a loser. It's more to get things worked out so everybody happy.
The best interest.
Yeah, yeah.
The children.
Mr. Moon.
The question that I have goes back to a little earlier in your presentation, where the federal government put Inkscape corporations on the same list as federally recognized tribes. Has there been any additional clarification on that, or in the law, are they still one and the same?
No, I'm glad you asked that. Well, obviously, I couldn't do my federal Indian law 101. I tried my best. But I hope you understand, based on this conversation about the political and the sovereignty issue, that's the only way you can have Indian law. Otherwise, it is racial discrimination, which is illegal in our Constitution, okay? So it's a government-to-government relationship. So you can understand how distressing it was when for-profit state-chartered companies and I wish them all well so that they benefit their shareholders and their descendants and all that. They should be well and do well. But Doyon is not a tribe. Okay? It's a company with accountants and lawyers, and they have to file with the state and the whole nine yards. Siri is not a tribe. Sea Alaska is not a tribe. I know I'm probably going to be attacked in the parking lot, but, you know. Yeah, okay, good. So that's distressing when all of a sudden they end up on that list and creating that confusion, because that's big confusion. It's not a small matter. So they've been since taken off the list, but they're not done, because there's incredible bargaining power in certain areas that a tribe has that other people do not, because of this government-to-government relationship. And certain corporations have lobbied dangerously close to be called tribes, to have those benefits, those sovereign benefits. And so sovereignty watchdogs, you know, flip out every time that this happens. And it happens like once every few congressional sessions, somebody starts sneaking up the fish passageway to try to start saying, we're a tribe. No, you're not.
So at this point, they're not recognized.
They're not recognized.
Thank you.
Now, hold on. We have some qualifications. Go ahead.
Well, Siri, the Inlet region, has actually gotten on the list for money purposes. For the purposes of funding for different areas. Mm. And so, for example, if there is a pot of money for tribal courts or justice programs, Siri can compete for that money. But if a tribe says, no, we want to take that money, then we get precedence. So oftentimes what's happening is our corporate entities or the tribal organizations will go after the funding and compete directly with the tribes. And if the tribes don't know they're competing for it, then they get it.
Huh.
Over us.
Right. So the confusion still is out there, because certain statutes in particular, the Self-Determination Act, in the definition sections where it defines tribe, still includes corporations and nonprofit organizations like Manelik and Bristol Bay Native Association. So there's an immense array of Native organizations. But at least the Department of Interior list of federally recognized tribes has remained pristine, I think.
Relative.
Yes. Go ahead. Yeah. My pleasure to be here.
Secondly, my question is on ANGSCA in particular. Like, what would you do, and what do you think should be done about this in order to make it something that's less towards assimilation and more towards integration?
Damn, that's a good question, right? That's a great question. I have not read all the way. I have to admit, I just breeze through it because I get a snowdrift of information per day. But they make some recommendations in this Indian Law and Order Commission report that I was telling you about, and I haven't had a chance. I was too busy looking at, like, blistering, I think is the word that a lot of people, blistering criticism of why Alaska's the plaintiff in all of those cases, and what's going on out in the villages is a nightmare. So I was doing the wow factor. But they actually make some recommendations. One of the ones I think I would throw out there is that to date, the Department of Interior has refused to take land back into trust. So there is a process for Indian tribes, and some of the more wealthy ones are actually going out and rebuying back their territory. They lost it through all kinds of shenanigans. Now they're doing better, and they're just buying neighborhood after neighborhood, and they're rebuilding their reservation with their own in the free market. And so they have the ability to then go to the Department of the Interior and say, we would like this land converted back into trust. Now it really starts to look like Indian country again. And to date, the Department of the Interior That was one of my except for Alaska things before my trusty computer took a nap, has refused to do that. They were just body slammed in the district court in Washington, D.C. for discriminating against Alaska tribes. They had no basis for it. It's just this weird except for in Alaska thing, right? And so that was just overturned. So it seems to me that that's what Venati tried to do. They had angst forced on them. They weren't interested in it. They're a more traditional people. They're hunting. They have a subsistence, customary, traditional way of life. They had their language. They didn't want to be a corporation. Well, you have to be. But we don't want to be. You have to be. Fine. Give it to me. Are we done yet? And then they gave it right back to their tribal government. So they have 1.4 million acres owned by their tribal government. They tried to recreate their reservation. But the Supreme said, no, it's fee simple. Like, so this weird property concept, they now no longer have governmental jurisdiction over their 1.4 million acres that they own. They want to regulate fish and wildlife. They want to tell you who can poop in the stream and who can't. They want to make sure that what's going on there, and that's what governments do through zoning and taxation and property development regulations. But they're not allowed to do that. So what's the solution? To go back to Department of the Interior and say, we want to put it in trust. And if that happens, it's Indian country. Done. They just circumvented Venati. And now they have what they need to do for self-determination. That's all I can hope for. Let me say one other thing while I'm yapping at you. Sorry. One of the great things that I have found about Alaska Native people is their ingenuity. Right? There was an old elder silver carver in Sitka, and people would come in off the cruise ship boats to watch him carve, right? And so one Weisenheimer saw him with like an electric drill, right? And this guy's got, he's got Coke bottle glasses, and then he's got magnifying glasses on top of his Coke bottle glasses, right? So his eyes looked whack, right? And so this Weisenheimer off the cruise ship goes, I bet your grandfather didn't use that kind of tool, right? And he looks up and he goes, if my grandfather could have got hold of this tool, he would have used it. So ANCSA and the corporations and the capitalistic drive of that world has usefulness somehow. And Native people are figuring and will figure and have figured how to use that tool. So I'm not one of these people that says, you know, blowtorch it all, you know. But integration is a brilliant word. Go ahead. What were you going to say before I yapped?
You brought up a very interesting point there. I don't really want to get rid of ANCSA myself. Mm. I recognize fiat currency here as kind of the tribe's power in this Western society, one that we didn't. The natives of the South didn't really get to enjoy. So they got mistreated a lot more than we did, from what I hear.
Huh.
The other thing that I wanted to know is, why haven't I heard of a tribal court in Alaska before?
Huh. Well, part of that, sorry, he's coming to get me. Part of that's by design. There's a famous saying, you don't know you have a head until you have a headache, right? So tribal courts, as we were saying, I think you were on this phone call with me the other day where I was spouting off as usual, but tribal courts are a sister sovereign and has been mostly silent and invisible. And that means she's doing her job because I think Chief Justice Fabe is starting to recognize that there's this other court system underneath the Alaska court system shouldering a huge amount of the burden of cases that would otherwise fill the dockets. They couldn't handle it. And so tribal courts are handling all these cases nicely, non-confrontationally. People walk away and they actually, I don't know if they're laughing or smiling, but they're not screaming. You know, so you don't really hear about a court until you have a headache. And thank God that it's been going great. There's been some cases some of us would wish would, you know, go away. But for the most part, it's been going well. And that's why you haven't heard about them. The one case that is getting noise right now that my cohort brought up is a case out of the Tanana Chiefs region where they refuse to let attorneys speak. Much like Kanaitse. Hey, if you want to pay that monkey in a suit to be here, by all means, enjoy. But he doesn't get to open his mouth. And this person's arguing that is a violation of their fundamental due process. And so I want to throw that out to you guys, because this is a case of new impression. I don't think there's a case all over the United States that has this issue. Do you have a right to have your attorney speak for you?
Well, is it sovereign or isn't it? If it is sovereign, then is it another country? Is it another country's laws? And therefore, do you have a right to due process in that country?
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's hold that. Great answer. Give me something from over this side of the room. Yeah. That's both good questions. To your first answer, for the most part, yes, I write opinions. But, you know, I'm also a word freak. That you can rule from the bench orally, and it's on record. It's most tribes record their proceedings either in log notes or actual with equipment. So you don't have to write an opinion. But I usually do, because our court has a right of appeal, and I like to cover my tuchus and also put out there how I made this decision. And I tell people, you can, and if you think you should, appeal me. You know, I put on my pants the same way you do in the morning. I could get this wrong. And so, yes, I write, I want to say 95% of all my decisions. I became a judge because the people that I worked for are highly competitive. And they have inter-clan disputes that go back longer than any of us could ever remember. And so it was an easy pick to have the guy without the bone in the fight to help with their court. And also they were wanting to grow it. And the hard part about the comedy John V. Baker decision is, well, they are holding tribal courts. You know, the sovereignty thing goes so far, but you remember that I wrote plenary power, right? So eventually there is a wall where they start wagging their finger. And if at worst comes to worst, the U.S. Marshals and National Guard can come in. You know, if you make a decision that's outer limits, it could get ugly. And so one of the things they are holding tribal courts to is due process. Now, the question is, what does that mean? So the Black's Law Dictionary is notice. We shouldn't make decisions without telling you. That's not fair. And a right to be heard. But does that right to be heard include attorneys? This side of the room. Give me an opinion. Yes, in the back.
I have a question, actually.
Yeah.
The major
Oh, man, this is a tough crowd, right? Okay, so you're lucky I just read this book, The Roundhouse, because it freshened me up. Basically, there was a case. Oh, my God. Help me. What's the name of the two Indians that got into a fight?
Crow Dog.
Thank you. Ex parte Crow Dog. So what happened was there was a conflict on the reservation between a leader, a chief, that was put into power by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the traditional chief. And somehow push came to shove, and the traditional chief killed the BIA plant. And this is a no-no in everyone's culture, including, I believe it was in the Dakotas.
Yeah.
Help me. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the way it went to tribal court, And the way it was resolved was traditionally Crow Dog. Was Crow Dog the murderer or the one who was murdered?
Thank you so much.
So Crow Dog shot Spotted Tail. So Crow Dog was responsible now for the subsistence and the financial and economic welfare now of Spotted Tail's family. And there was horses exchanged, blankets exchanged. It was a repair of the tear in the community the way that they always had done. Well, that was disturbing to the non-native population that felt like justice wasn't served. And they wanted to hang Crow Dog. And out of this, I believe the Supreme Court said, no, 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 no. They are sovereign. They are their own nation. And this is how they decided. And Congress quickly freaked out and passed the Major Crimes Act. And so the United States has taken upon itself jurisdiction over major crimes, like rape, murder.
Most felonies.
Most serious felonies. And it's not working. So I'm not sure, you know, you hit me with this question, so I'll just talk out my rear end for a second. I think that jurisdiction should be given back to the tribes, but they need the resources to be able to deal with it. That's the hard part that we run into every day, is tribal courts are growing by leaps and bounds, and the state of Alaska relies on us and has started shoving cases our way, the ones that they don't want, the very high needs, expensive cases, child in need of aid cases. Now they're like, oh, we love your sovereignty. Here you go. You know, as they throw file after file off of their desk onto our desk. Problem is, there's not a penny attached. And so we are holding our courts together with duct tape and blue tarps, you know, the Alaska way. And it's just ridiculous. So if tribes were to start taking on felonies, they would need to be given the resources to deal with it because the criminal justice system is expensive.
Generally, the tribal courts would do a better job of it. Yes.
I would hope so. I would hope so, but I do not know.
The political climate is swinging towards, because the courts across the United States for years, if you look at the number of incarcerated persons, and the cost of that, as opposed to the cost of education, where are we putting our money? And it's asked backwards. And so even the judiciary is realizing that what we're doing isn't working. There's an example of Leech Lake, Minnesota, where the Superior Court judge had a revolving door for the Leech Lake Indian Reservation people that were DWIs, domestic violence, you name it. So that was one visionary non-native that went to the reservation and said, what I'm doing is not working. I need your help. What can I do? And so he actually takes his court onto the reservation, and they use traditional Indian law to adjudicate the cases and even for penalties. And so we're seeing now where there's circle justice going on, and that's becoming
God bless you.
Used in the judiciary is finding out that natives really know what's best for their people, and the chances, or that's not a good word, of rehabilitation are much, much higher than throwing it into the clink. It's not working. So I think when I say yeah, we can do a better job, it's because most Native groups know their people better than a judge that sits up on a bench above and doesn't get down in the faces of the people to look at it as what's the problem and what do you think is the solution to that problem and how are we going to make it happen?
What I can tell you also is we have a program in Sitka where we get the minor consuming offenders, so we're not talking felonies here. But the crazy part about minor consuming alcohol is that it is the gateway to the prison system. For some weird reason, if you get a minor consuming, are you going to prison? No. But if you're in prison, did you get a minor consuming? Yes. That's what they're finding. So for whatever reason, this minor consuming is a crossroads for young people. And so we've been fortunate, we worked out an agreement with the city and borough of Sitka where we get them. And it's a much more rehabilitatory process. We attach them. We had one guy who was awesome carver. So guess who gets to do an internship with Tommy Joseph, a nationally renowned carver. If he went to the state court, he'd get whacked, he'd get his fine, he'd have to sweep the YMCA, and he's done. With me, he's going and he's carving a totem pole. Or I had one Filipino young lady interview her great-grandparents of how they met and got married. They were like, she had her great-grandparents. They were like 106. And just, I was like, wow, during the hearing. I was like, that's amazing. I'm like, did you ever ask them how they met? She was like, no. I'm like, boo, guess who's sitting down with grandmama tonight with tea? And she wrote me a whole essay about it. You know what I mean? So we're trying to engage, to light a fire in somebody's life, as opposed to next, you know, poppy mill justice. Some more love. You know what I'm saying?
So many of our people don't realize what has happened on it when we look, you know, academia is calling it generational trauma. And things, when we talk about ANCSA, most of us didn't know that the tribes, not all the tribes in Alaska, sanctioned that at all. It wasn't ratified. And then when we who are maybe pro-ANCSA or pro, what was the other alternative, go to look at it, the federal government, in that negotiation of ANCSA, knew that in order for tribes to thrive and be healthy, needed at least 80 million acres of land. Now, do you know how much land the ANCSA tribes were given? Huh?
44.
43, I think it was.
Yeah.
43, 44.
Yeah.
So they gave us enough to make us think that we got the good end of the deal. But yet, in order for our people to thrive and be who we are and continue to take care of our needs and our people, we weren't given the full measure of what we needed to do that.
Yeah. But one cause for optimism that I'm kind of getting into lately was that I went to a conference and they started talking about this concept of epigenetics. I don't know if anybody's heard about it, but it's basically they're going back to Lamarck. Darwin had won and now they're going back to Lamarck. And the truth is somewhere in the middle. So it was nature versus nurture, right? And so the prevailing genetic scientific theory is that your DNA is given to you and you know what happens to you in life, of course, has an impact on you, but it cannot impact your genetic material. Well, guess what? They're finding out differently, that actually profound experiences in our lives can have modification effects on our DNA, which then means when we have children, we pass on that epigenetic morph from that powerful experience. And so what happens to you in life is being handed down, not only by the way you teach your kids, but also your DNA. Now that door swings both directions. So my colleague brings up something called intergenerational trauma. And that is the flood that I was talking about earlier. That's not nice. Whole villages were lost to disease, starvation, horrible things happened. And so families were taken apart and sent to boarding schools. We could go over, it's unbelievable, the history, which I encourage you to learn. We don't have time to go over it all. But traumatic, traumatic impacts. And so we lost a generation of parents because they were sent to boarding schools. They sometimes were abused by their teachers and then sent back home, have kids, have fun. But they didn't get to watch their parents, how they got to raise kids. They were stuck in a boarding school. So how do you be a parent? So we lost a generation of parents and the epigenetic morph of that trauma. And so now is the time to heal. So the door swings the hard way, but also the good way. If we can create profound experiences for our young people that are positive. Not only are we plastering a smile across somebody's face, making somebody's day, we could be altering the genetic future of our population with goodness, which is what I think why we got into the business. Now, how you get there is a bizarre road. Each of us has our bizarre story to tell you. How do you end up being a tribal judge? There's no tribal judge track at UAA that I'm aware of yet. Maybe Professor Fortson's working on it. You know, it will happen one way or another, but you get into the business to do it differently and to heal, I think, is why we got into it anyway. Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Moon.
Can you talk a little bit about jurisdiction with respect to tribal courts? Earlier you said that tribal courts were about sovereignty, not about race, and that the sovereign determines the membership. So what's the relationship between, like in an example, when you've got two tribes that are very close and might have geographic overlay, I'm not sure I'm expressing my question.
I got it, though. It's a great question. Okay, so before any tribal judge renders a decision, although I did this maybe not so great the other day, you should announce at the beginning of your opinion why you have jurisdiction. Jurisdiction is a fancy Latin word for meaning you have the right to talk. You know, diction, juris, law, you can talk the law. Otherwise, you have no business making the decision, right? So there's two pieces, personal and subject matter. Do you have a right to talk about this person? And do you have a right to talk about this subject matter? And so the citizenship is the linchpin, a major piece of the jurisdiction that gives you personal jurisdiction. And the law is pretty settled right now. Tribal courts are allowed to talk about their own citizens. Now, where the mush comes from. And a particular area of subject matter jurisdiction to help you understand that is families. Because what is a tribe? A big family, a collection of families. So when it comes down to family law and something that's happening to a kid, does a tribe have subject matter jurisdiction to talk about children? Of course they do. Does the tribe have jurisdiction to talk about something that's going on in Finland? Probably not. Maybe, but probably not, right? So the first piece is, who are we talking about? And if they are a tribal citizen, you're on safe ground. And if you're talking about a topic that's near and dear to the tribe's heart, you're on safe ground. Now, where the mush comes from, and you knew there was mush coming, is what happens when one of the parties is not a member of the tribe, not a citizen. Do you have jurisdiction over them? State of Alaska says no. My position, because he spiked my tea, is it depends. If that person, I don't care if you're black, white, yellow, purple, whatever, if you come to the village and you voluntarily avail yourself of the privileges and benefits of being connected to that tribe, you have subjected yourself to personal jurisdiction. Case in point, I rent a car in Seattle. I drive across the Columbia River. I am now in Oregon. It's so beautiful. Bam! I wasn't paying attention. I was texting, right? The Oregon State Trooper comes over and gives me a ticket. No, you don't have jurisdiction over me. I'm from Washington. Well, buddy, you came to Oregon. We'll see you in court, okay? So, too, if someone enters into a relationship with the Kanaitse and then decides to misbehave, God forbid, hit a Kanaitse woman, from where I'm coming from, it's as old as snot. They have jurisdiction over you. This is something that's going to have to be litigated. It's coming up right here and now. In this Parks case, where whether you have an attorney, no one ever answered the question except for this gentleman over here, do you have a fundamental right to have your attorney speak? But in that case, it is a native person from a village not far away. but he is not a citizen in Minto, which is the one that terminated his parental rights. The child is Minto. The mom is Minto. Dad is from somewhere else but Alaska Native, and saying, you don't have jurisdiction over me. Well, my position, and I think this will eventually be clarified, is no, you entered into relationship with Minto. You are now subject to their jurisdiction. But it's not 100% clear yet. It will be in the next 10 years.
Well, if you had, it seems to me like if that person were part of another tribe, then it would be an intertribal court.
It could be. It could be. That's a great point. But it started in Minto. And just kind of the way that courts work,
okay,
usually where it starts is where it should be.
Okay.
But an intertribal conference would not have been a bad idea. And maybe his tribe would have said, we hereby delegate jurisdiction over Homie to you. Because this gentleman beat this woman within an inch of her life. He is now in jail for 50-some years. For she's unrecognizable, right? So we're not talking about a little parking ticket here. So maybe an intertribal conference where this tribe said, you know what? He came over there and did that. By all means, we think you have jurisdiction, but just in case there's any doubters out there, we're delegating jurisdiction to you. And then it's lock, stock, two smoking barrels, I think. Yes.
Yeah. Because we are the third largest, the Kenai Peninsula is the third largest growing native population from outlying villages. We have several people petitioning our court that don't want to get involved in the state court, especially in regards to custody or China cases, and it's free to come to our court. It's not, you don't have to pay any filing fees. So we have them contact their tribe, especially if it's just a custody case. The tribe will either grant us jurisdiction. They have the option to sit concurrent, which means they call in with the judge, we make the decisions jointly, or they can say, it's all yours. Can I see handle it? So we do those three options. Right now on our docket, we only have probably 7 or 8 cases that are actually connecting Indian tribal members. The rest are all resolutions from other tribes asking us to sit to handle their cases. And we have a concurrent jurisdiction with Chantlaw Chief.
Cool. Here's another piece I wanted to tell you. I get a lot of non-natives in my court down in Juneau, and I always say, here's my position. Jurisdiction follows the child is my position, okay? I don't give a hoot about the parents. Obviously, one of the parents needs to be a tribal member. But really, I'm talking about the kid. And I say that to them. I believe jurisdiction follows your child. But we have a practice of inviting you in as a welcome guest to this court. Are you comfortable consenting to jurisdiction? 99.9 say, heck yeah. They'd much rather be in my court than up the hill with Johnny Blackrobe up on his pedestal costing God knows what with a bazillion rules. You know, they feel comfortable getting it done in our court. And so I've only had one non-native play squirrely with me. I knew this person anyway. He was always looking for an angle, you know, and he was like, oh, you know, when we had a child support case, he's like, oh, you might not have jurisdiction over me? No, I don't consent. I'm like, okay, I'm sending you to the state. And by the way, they charge interest. You know, bye-bye. And so we eventually, you know, fine, you want that? You got it. But 99 out of 100 say, want to stay right here. So really, the worry is more of a boogeyman than reality. I think non-natives are very, I don't know, do you guys have non-natives in your court? They are so happy and pleased to be in a tribal court.
If the Parks case actually goes through the way this, they want it to, and we only have jurisdiction over our members, then we can't hear any of our China cases, because I can't think of one case where it is two Kenaitse Indian tribal members with a Kenaitse child. There isn't one.
Yeah.
So if we could have one more question, then we can wrap it up.
Okay, sorry.
Yes, because you keep mentioning about if somebody hired a lawyer, how would that lawyer, even though he is not allowed to speak in court, what law is he, would he be following? Because, you know, when it comes to jurisdiction, it would be in the village and tribe. You know, yeah, it would be, just to answer your question, I don't think a lawyer would be very effective in the situation like that.
And the truth is, you're right. They're not effective in tribal court at all. In fact, they're anti-effective because we're problem solving. You know, we're not trying to win. I've had some lawyers come to my court. We make them join our bar, you know, take a little skin off their tuchus there. We accept credit cards. No, I'm just kidding. So, you know, we have them join our bar, and our codes are available. They are written, and they're online. Not every tribe has to be like that, and they would follow tribal law. And in one case, I had a very respectful attorney who was just pleased as punch to sit back and let it ride because I was driving and he knew where I was going. And then I had one attorney who did not think I was an attorney by trade and tried to get up on top of me, you know, in the rutting season, if you catch what I'm saying. And, you know, I had to just put him down. You know, he was ineffective assistance of counsel, trying to bully me. And we have that problem right now in Sitka. There's a case where I'm not the primary judge on it. There's a lay judge on it because you don't need to be an attorney to be a tribal court judge. What you need is some common sense and wisdom, God willing, and humility and all these other things that a judge should have. But a law degree is not one of them. And so we get these attorneys that start trying to do their little dance, try to make the attorney feel intimidated. I mean, the tribal judge feel intimidated. And that's why Kanaitse wisely says, zip it.
That's what's wrong with the legal system in the country now. It's not a matter of what's right, what's wrong, who's trying to fix who with what. It's a matter of who wins. Was a winner or a loser? How much money you got? That's it.
So one thing I will say is if you're interested in these issues, I do teach a Alaska Native law class, so I certainly invite you. We cover many of the cases that Judge Volok addressed, and we're covering many contemporary issues. For instance, this week we're reading the Simmons versus Parks briefing. So
All right. We
do cover a lot of these issues. But can we please have a wonderful thanks for Judge Volok?